Hi, this is Ken McCarthy of Jazz on the Tube, and today we're going to talk about a very interesting and important book about the history of American culture, and specifically the history of jazz. I learned so much from this book, I can't even begin to tell you. We're going to get into some of the details. We're going to talk to the author, how this book even came to be, and then one of the most poignant stories, I think, in all jazz history, we're going to go into in some depth. So I'd like to welcome to our airways Martin Targoff. Welcome, Martin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Martin's book is called Bop Apocalypse, Jazz, Race, the Beats, and Drugs. And it is a social history of, well, all those things. And I'd say roughly the book's divided between the history of the beats and the history of jazz. And like it or not, you know, drug culture played an important role in the jazz world and in the beat world, and, you know, sometimes a very destructive role, but it's part of the history. And it's fascinating to get into that and see how it came to be, what the dynamics were involved socially, the effect it had on individual musicians, and on the direction of American culture. But first, Martin, if you would, for people that aren't already aware of your work, would you mind telling us a little about yourself? I know you're an author, a researcher, a documentary filmmaker.
Yes, I am. I write books. I've been a journalist. I am a documentary filmmaker. I'm a writer, producer, and director of television. And, you know, I go back to the 1970s when I began in book publishing as an editor, focusing on pop culture and music and the arts in the books that I published. I kind of pioneered a genre of publishing at that point, along with a few other people, called oversized trade paperbacks. And what they were exactly that, but text and image presentations of musicians, and that was really the beginning of my work writing about music and making films about it. And from there, I left publishing. My first book was a book about Elvis Presley. That was very well received. You know, I come out of the rock generation. Mm-hmm. You know, I came of age during the 1960s. So Elvis really wasn't my guy, but I kind of fell into it, and I realized that what I really loved to do was explore music that had not been a part of my initial experience.
And so I've done
that over and over, you know, whether it's hip-hop or, and now in the case of jazz. I mean, I did start getting into jazz in the 1970s when I started working in New York. The first jazz club I went to was Slugs, down on the Lower East Side. I was about 18, and it was an amazing place, and it was just so different from the kind of rock culture that I had grown up in. And that was the beginning of my fascination with jazz, and I never really lost it. It just kept growing and growing over the years. And my own career took an interesting arc after that book. Andy Warhol read the book, and he was obsessed with Elvis. He loved it, and he invited me to come down and write for his magazine Interview, which I did, and that was kind of my introduction. That was a portal into the entire cultural landscape of New York City at the time.
Sure.
And I focused on, I wrote about a lot of things there, but I focused on music. And then I met John Mellencamp as a result of interviewing him, and he invited me to come work on video stuff with him. And that was the beginning of my career behind the camera. And I wrote a book on him that won the ASCAP Deans Taylor Award. And then in the early night, you know, all during this time I was working in the film and television end of the music industry and making documentaries and long-form pieces, the entire range of music, you know, from Philip Glass to Aerosmith and Prince. But in the early 90s, I wanted to write books again. And by that time, I was in my own recovery from my own addictions.
Uh-huh.
At the age of 37, I kind of crashed and burned. And when I started coming out of that, I became very interested in really looking at, God, you know, drugs, what did they mean? What did they mean in my life? What did they mean in my generation's life? And that led to thinking, what did they, you know, mean to my country? And that was the beginning of a 12-year odyssey that ended, culminated with a book called Can't Find My Way Home, America in the Great Stoned Age. And what that was the story of how drugs went from the underground to the mainstream and how that shaped the cultural landscape of modern America. But in doing that, I went deep, deep, deep into the roots of it all, deep into jazz, deep into the Beat Generation, because that there is where you find the seeds to what became known as, you know, the American counterculture, which was my generation. And the more I got into it, the more I realized, wow, you really can't understand any of this unless you, like, really go back and understand the beginning. So I had had a chapter in that book, Can't Find My Way Home, called Bop Apocalypse. But I had written, like, I don't know, 90,000 words, like 300-400 pages of a manuscript on that material, and I had only been able to use a kernel of it. And so, you know, years later, I always wanted to go back and write that book about the early part of the story, but fleshed out with the full cast of characters. And this, at long last, is that book.
Well, you sure did it. I mean, you sure fleshed it out. I mean, anybody that's interested in the history of the Beats and or the history of jazz, you're going to learn things from this book that you never knew. I mean, it goes so deep. And it's an unblinking look. And that, based on your, you know, your background that you described, it explains, it makes sense. I mean, you just look at this stuff, you know, unblinking. You're looking right at it. And some of it was quite ugly. I mean, let's face it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, my own experience with addiction kind of, I think, gave me, in the long run, a kind of viewpoint that was helpful in a way, authentic, because I was able to look at some of these people who were addicts and really understand what they went through and really humanize it. You know, in my own experience, drugs were, you know, they embodied everything from good to terrible. You know, some of them, you know, opened me and, you know, sort of gave me a kind of creative stance, and others, like, really closed me down and damaged me. And I think to a degree, that's exactly what happened to the jazz guys and girls and, you know, the Beats, you know, but they were the beginning of it. I mean, what's so fascinating about this story is that marijuana first shows up on the streets of New Orleans around 1910, you know, and it's brought there by Mexicans and, you know, people from the Caribbean. That city is like a total melting pot of everything, as you know. And that is exactly when jazz begins to coalesce, jazz as we know it. So the two of them were always there in close proximity from the very beginning. And, you know, you can follow the story. I mean, you can follow the story of Reefer along with jazz, where it goes. When it goes up the river to Chicago, you know, in the 20s, in the form of, you know, Pops, Louis Armstrong, and his cohorts. And then it comes across to New York, and it goes down to Kansas City, and it goes like that. So, you know, I mean, I understand that there is a sensitivity, a deep sensitivity about the whole idea of African Americans, the whole idea of this art form being related to this phenomenon, which later becomes, you know, so mainstream. because a lot of people, you know, including the whole regime of jazz prohibition, drug prohibition, and the drug laws and the drug war and the culture war over drugs was aimed at these people from the very beginning, from the outset. And it was racist, undeniably racist. But the impact of the substances, it's kind of fascinating to think about. I mean, obviously it had an impact on the scene, wherever it was, whether it was, you know, in New Orleans or the Lincoln Gardens in Chicago or the Savoy Ballroom in New York. It had an impact on the scene, but it had an impact on the music, too. And it's ultimately unknowable because these people did not talk specifically about how it was affecting them. But you can conjecture about it. It's fun to do so. Other people have done it. Would Louis Armstrong have been a different player if he had never smoked marijuana, which he smoked every day of his life from the time he came to Chicago to his last day on the earth, every day?
Right, and he was very open about it. It wasn't a big secret.
No, he was open about it, and he believed that it was relatively harmless and that there were things about it that were beneficial. He even wrote a letter to Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, telling him that he thought it should be legalized, which is pretty crazy when you think about it.
Well, could you imagine? That would have changed history if Eisenhower had picked up on that. And
yes.
and we know, in addition to the, I mean, I think anybody that has imbibed in any of these substances and loves music probably can tell you some stories about where the substance and the music were really intertwined, and it would be hard to separate the experience.
Like, for example, I write about Armstrong and I write about Lester Young quite a bit. They were very different personalities musically and just as people. And, you know, and the marijuana had a different effect on them. You know, with Pops, it made him more of himself. I mean, who was, you know, this warm, glowing, genial person who, you know, wanted to give of himself to the world, who believed in, you know, the brotherhood of man. With Prez, it pulled him deeper into himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just, I mean, he was shy, he was withdrawn anyway, but it pulled him deeper into himself. It kind of created a bubble around him where he was able to just withdraw and, in doing so, just create himself as this, you know, this unbelievably eccentric, memorable, you know, unique personality, like one of the most influential personalities in all of jazz, I think, just because.
Well, apparently a lot of the words that we use, some of the words that we use, come straight from him.
Oh, right. Well, he was the man who invented cool, not just cool jazz, which was his style, you know, from the swing era, but just the concept of it. Culturally, what we have come to know as cool comes from Prez directly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was the first guy to say, and scores of musicians will corroborate this, he was the first guy to say cool as in, that's cool, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he was one of the first to wear sunglasses at night, sunglasses on stage. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. You know, all the aspects of him, from his language to his style of music, his style of dress, mm-hmm. you know, the pork pie hat. He was really something. And, you know, I mean, of course, he became an alcoholic as time went on. And I write in the book about how, you know, in 1943, a young college student named Jack Kerouac, a young Columbia student who is just getting into jazz, is introduced to Lester Young in the Village one night, and they share a cab together up to Minton's, where the whole bebop revolution was percolating, and they share something else, because Prez gives Kerouac his first marijuana. And
no kidding.
That, Yes, that is a huge moment in Kerouac's life. And, you know, the irony is that, you know, as time went on for different, they both were in love with marijuana, but as time went on for different reasons, both of them became alcoholics. You know, in Prez's case, there's a lot of conjecture about, you know, when he was taken into the army and had such a nightmarish experience, he was never really the same after that. And, you know, with Kerouac, all the years of rejection before he became famous, and they actually died the exact same death, you know, the deaths of an alcoholic, you know, hemorrhaging, you know, just horrible. But so the entire arc of the narrative encompasses all of that, you know, it's like unbelievable peak moments and then, you know, just the despair. I mean, when you get into the heroin era, that's really where you see the damage of drugs. I mean, the astonishing thing is that, you know, between the 40s, between 47 and 57, you know, people estimate that as much as 75% of the musicians were using heroin. And that's an astonishing thing to think about. I mean, how on earth did they create that classic American music when they were all strung out like that?
Yeah, and it's not, you know, it's not a stereotype. It's not a slur or a slander. It's just the plain history, you know.
And history. It's usually avoided. I mean, unless there's a biography of Charlie Parker, or, you know, obviously with Lady Day, and there's been, you know, people have written about her drugs to the exclusion, really sort of like minimizing how brilliant she was as a musical talent. But yes, the reality is that, you know, this experience really engulfed their lives. And one of the things I do in the book is you follow a whole group of them through the whole phenomena of it. Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Jackie McLean. You know, Dexter Gordon said something once that was very interesting. The jazz critic Ira Gittler was doing a wonderful oral history called From Swing to Bop. And Dexter Gordon, you know, they were talking about that, and the way that Dexter Gordon expressed it was, we were playing our lifestyle. And that, you know, really kind of nails it for me. We were playing our lifestyle. So everything that went into their lifestyle went into the music. And, you know, and in a way, the Beats were writing their lifestyle, because they were so, you know, the impact of jazz on the lives of, you know, Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, I mean, it's just incalculable. I mean, they would not have been able to, you know, their breakthrough works, Kerouac's On the Road and Ginsberg's Howl, could never, never have been written without jazz.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the book is, your book is really interesting in that you trade fours, you know, in other words, it's, you do a chapter on the Beats, then a chapter on jazz, then back to the Beats, and then you really feel the connection between these two cultures. And of course you document the huge personal impact that jazz had on the players in the Beat world. You know, one thing about this high addiction rate in the past, my understanding of that kind of addiction is invariably there is deep personal misery that is leading a person into that. And I don't know what your reaction to that is, but, you know.
Well, I think it can certainly be an important part of it. In some cases, I mean, it's, you know, in the case of Billie Holiday, for example, you know, she became addicted to heroin exactly when her star was rising. And, you know, it's like, why? How? Why? Well, the fact of the matter is that, you know, her drug use was completely tied up with the men in her life. You know, her first husband, Jimmy Monroe, who was, you know, kind of a playboy. And he introduced her to cocaine. I mean, Lady had been smoking pot since she was a girl back in Fell's Point. But that's where she was introduced to hard drugs. And, you know, by the time her marriage to him was over, she was a heroin addict. And, of course, you know, the famous line from Lady Sings the Blues about how they gave me the white gardenias and they brought me the white junk. I mean, that was all in the 40s, just as her star was really, really rising. I mean, you know, her records were selling and people were just flat out falling in love with her. So why would she have done that at just at that moment? You know, I mean, and, you know, her, if you look back at her life and, you know, you look back at the sexual abuse, I mean, there's a lot of, the thing about Billie Holiday is so much has been written about her and so many people disagree about all of it. So you really kind of have to wade through. But if you kind of look at, you know, this rape that supposedly happened to her when she was a girl, you know, she once told Nat Hentoff that, she felt like the quote was a damn cripple from her youth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think that is a kind of classic part of an addict's makeup. You know, what we know today about the role that sexual abuse and trauma can play in the makeup of an addict or alcoholic. We know a lot about it now, but back then they didn't know anything.
Not only didn't they know anything, but they didn't really care. And that's something that you cover in your book, which is that this condition, you know, some call it an illness, but it's certainly an affliction, was seen as a crime. Unfortunately, it still is today. Instead of trying to help and offer help to people in this dilemma, they're treated as vicious criminals. And so not only didn't they not know, they didn't really care. They took a completely different viewpoint on it. I want to just say one thing, and then I'd like to talk more about Billie Holiday in a second. But you often hear this story. It's a very common narrative. I played music in the church. I got interested in jazz. I wanted to play jazz, and my parents forbade me from even getting near it. And I'll tell you, once somebody reads Martin's book, you'll realize why so many, you know, straight, arrow, church-going, God-fearing people that wanted a stable and healthy life for their children were afraid of jazz in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
They were terrified of it. I mean, I think the main reason was that jazz was the one place, it was the purest form of cultural miscegenation in the country. I mean, it was mm-hmm. the one place where whites and blacks were really connecting in an authentic way. I mean, if you look at the Savoy Ballroom in New York, I mean, even the years before, you know, marijuana was made illegal in 1937, it was the nexus of it all. It was like one of the only places where white kids and black kids could dance together and, you know, and talk and, you know, get to know each other. And it was a place where, you know, jazz was happening, you know, the big band era. And it was also a place where marijuana was, you know, this viper culture was developing. And so, you know, this guy, Harry Anslinger, who was the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics for over 30 years, I mean, he was there for as long as J. Edgar Hoover ran the FBI, and he was the overseer of drug policy and drug enforcement. He was the guy, and he was a racist, I mean, in the purest sense of the word. And, you know, to him, what it was all about was protecting white girls from black jazz musicians. And, you know, he saw that as, you know, the most pernicious thing going on in the whole country, really. And, you know, and that was the war that he wanted to wage. I mean, there were signature images of the marijuana smoker in his campaign to make marijuana illegal, you know, the famous Reefer Madness campaign. One was a schoolyard pusher who was going to, you know, get your kids hooked the second one was like a wild axe murderer, because, you know, there was, you know, all this bullshit going on about how it turned you into like a fiend. And then, and the third one, though, was a Negro jazz musician. That was the third danger.
Wow, that's right. Wow, that was how it was portrayed. And this one guy, Anslinger, really was the source of all of this mad propaganda, which then served his career purposes. And, you know, a lot of these, I noticed in your book, one of your references is the writing of Douglas Valentine, who's written about the history of drug enforcement and other things. And these were basically the guys that were out of a job after Prohibition. They needed work. So
exactly.
they demonized drugs and drug
exactly.
users.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
and if you really look at what happened afterward, you see that all of the stuff, you know, why do we have the largest prison population in the world today with its gross racial disparity? You know, black men have been criminalized more for drugs in this country than whites at rates which are just phenomenally, obscenely greater. And, you know, even though every study ever done shows that, you know, people are people and white people and black people use drugs at the same rate, why are our prisons filled with black men?
Yep.
And it all begins in this era. You know, I mean, you could never have had things like the crack statutes, you know, that criminalized black men who, you know, involved with crack at a rate 100 times greater than white men involved with powder cocaine, without, you know, some of these policies that began in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And, you know, the two laws that Anslinger shepherded against narcotics, against heroin in the 50s, that's the beginning of all the mandatory minimums and what became the Rockefeller laws in New York. And so this is a living history. That's how I see it.
You know, I don't know if you've come across this in your research. I only just stumbled on it myself. There's actual live recording of one of Nixon's henchmen. I can't remember which one it is offhand. It might have been Haldeman or one of the other ones. And he's saying, and it's on tape, it's not even text, you can hear him in his own words. He said, we criminalized heroin so that we could go after the blacks, and we criminalized marijuana so we could go after the anti-war protesters. He laid it out. This was something that he was saying decades later, admitting what was really behind it. And so it actually was a way to target specific populations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the reason that they were so successful at it was the whole idea of demonizing people who were different than yourself as the other, you know, as somehow the people who were going to be the ruination of the civilization. That was always behind what was behind the war on drugs.
To a degree, a lot of jazz came out of the crucible of this social condition where black people were targeted, criminalized, and then we haven't even gotten into the working conditions of jazz musicians in those days. You know, it's a hard life no matter what era you're playing, trying to be an artist in, but you know, from club to club, and you know, the shows start at 8, you know, there's 5 sets until 3 in the morning, and then you're in the car and driving to the next place, and the people hanging around at the end of the show are not necessarily the most savory people in the world, and you know, they were just immersed in a very challenging environment. And then
exactly, and a lot of them were kids. They were kids. They were vulnerable. They were, you know... The whole heroin thing in the story of Bebop is really fascinating and disturbing. You know, I mean, the role that Charlie Parker plays, for example, I mean, you know, no one really knew about these substances at that time. I mean, Dizzy Gillespie said it best. He said, you know, drugs victimized black musicians before the black community at large. And, mm-hmm. you know, so they had no idea what they were getting into. Not a clue. You know, they saw Bird, who was this genius, brilliant imitator who had been a heroin addict since he was 16 years old. You know, it was like so deeply ingrained in his being. And there are those of us who are like that. You know, for whatever reason, we are predisposed towards that kind of addiction. And he was one of them, unfortunately. And, you know, they all saw this guy who would, you know, they saw his lifestyle, and then they would see him get up on the stage and just blow them away. And it was like Hampton Hawes said, you know, we wanted to get some of that grease pumping through our veins. You know, he said he fucked up all our minds. That was his exact quote. And,
yep.
You know, so that was kind of the beginning of it. And, you know, so it was initially about hipness and rebellion and, you know, a kind of authenticity and, you know, a kind of isolation. This scene, this music, it was, not only was it isolated from the larger society in the beginning, it was isolated from the larger culture of jazz, you know, when it began.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a way, it kind of allowed them to construct this wall around themselves. And that's what happened. And you hear it over and over again, you know, how narcotics could be, you know, an anodyne, a bomb for racism. And I think that was a part of it, but only a part of it. I mean, I think fundamentally at the end, it's a human thing.
Sure.
More than a racial thing.
Sure.
And, you know, and then it, you know, you have to understand the times as well. I mean, bebop became the soundtrack for, you know, a whole generation of black guys who had gone into the service and then come out only to see that they were still very much second-class citizens. So,
and
you know, there was an anger there, too.
And, well, you know, and we learn more and more about that all the time. You know, for example, there's been with the problems in, drawing a blank on the name of the town, but in Missouri, the suburb of St. Louis, you know,
Ferguson.
And it was revealed that the whole town ran financially off of ridiculous fines that were placed on, you know, anybody that, you know, looked twice while crossing the street. You know, and you know, I think the average, literally, they took the population of the town, added up all the fines. Every family in that town was paying somewhere like $150 a year in harassment fines, basically. But then someone did some really interesting research, and I wish it had been better promoted. And it showed that, you know, whereas white servicemen were given mortgages and encouraged to move and buy new houses in all these beautiful new suburbs, black servicemen were denied that. And then the jobs that were available building those new communities, black tradesmen were not welcome in those unions. And it began the beginning of the intensification of a ghettoization process, because there was no place for, you know, the population was growing, but the housing stock wasn't growing. And so the details of this are just amazing when you finally learn about them. And that's what the black servicemen came home to after the war. So that you could understand disappointment, the rage, the alienation, because, you know, who wouldn't feel that way if they were confronted with that?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Hey, I'd like to talk about something. You know, we've talked about the darker side, and that's, you know, that's what, you know, history is history. One of my favorite authors, George Seldes, used to like to say, even the gods can't change history. You know, if we're serious about knowing history, we have to take the history as it is. And so a lot of this book looks, like I said earlier, unblinkingly at some dark stuff. But there's an episode in your book that I want everybody in the world to know about, and that is the utter heroism of Billie Holiday in bringing Strange Fruit to the public and keeping it in the public eye. Now, a lot of us are kind of, you know, we're aware that she popularized the song, and we're certainly aware of its social commentary, but very few of us, even I'd say some hardcore jazz fans, are aware of the personal price she paid and was willing to pay repeatedly to bring that song to the world. Could you talk a little bit about that story? Because I think it's one of the most important stories for me in all of jazz, now that I know it, thanks to you.
Well, when Lady got her booking at Cafe Society in the late 1930s, which was a very unique place because it was the first, like, posh downtown club where, you know, whites and blacks were really going to be together. You know, it happened uptown, but not so much downtown. And, you know, she was one of the first people that were signed. And, you know, that was really a showcase for her. All kinds of people would come to that place, and it was the exact antithesis of, you know, some of those uptown clubs where blacks couldn't go, like the Stork Club, and, you know, where the people were wealthy, and, you know, it was very much a kind of right-wing point of view. Cafe Society was very left-wing, and it was very interracial. And when she was there, the song was brought to her by the musical director. And there are different accounts as to what actually happened. And in a way, the different accounts kind of embody the different versions, the different points of view about Billie Holiday. I mean, there are some people who say, oh, you know, she did what anybody told her to do. You know, someone said, sing this song, she'd sing it. No.
Mm-hmm.
She was very, in a way, creatively independent, always was. She was strong-minded, strong-willed, and she knew what she was doing. And above all else, she was such a complicated package, so complex. But above all else, she was defiant. She was bold. And, you know, if you sort of look at the period leading up to Cafe Society, you see that, well, you know, what, she joined Artie Shaw's band. She was the first black singer to integrate an all-white orchestra. Big deal. And moreover, they went down south. Do you realize the moxie, the balls, it took to do something like that at that time? I mean, you know, they were chased by police, you know, across state lines because of it. So, you know, when she got back to New York and, you know, that was, she left the Artie Shaw Orchestra because they were booked into a hotel, and the owner of the hotel insisted that she use, you know, the service elevator, even though she was performing as a star with this orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And she just wouldn't take it. So she left. And by the time she came to Cafe Society, she had a very fully developed sensibility and conscience about racism and the implications of racism, because she had experienced it firsthand. Now, she knew about lynching. I mean, if you look at the movie Lady Sings the Blues, there's a scene where Diana Ross goes down south, you know, as Billie Holiday, and she witnesses a lynching. That never happened. But you couldn't have been a person of color in that Jim Crow era and not know about lynching. I mean, thousands of people had been lynched. There was a law, you know, an anti-lynching law submitted to Congress that was voted down, that was filibustered to death, that even President Roosevelt did not support. So here comes this song about lynching, you know, written by this left-wing Jewish New York school teacher named Abe Meerpol. And she made it her own. And it was, you know, you hear about, you know, the impact of it on the audiences of that time. I mean, people would get up and leave. People would break down weeping. And she was the conduit for bringing that consciousness into the culture at that time. You know, there are people who stay, like Ahmet Erdogan, you know, the great executive, you know, he claims that that was really the beginning of the civil rights movement in America. And you can make a case for it. You know, the first time that an artist of some stature in the musical community, like, really stood up like that. And it, she paid a price. She paid a price. I mean, personally, you know, she's quoted as saying that, you know, it took so much out of her just to perform it that sometimes she would have to go to the bathroom because she would get sick. You know, she would, it would make her ill singing the song because she would get, she would go so deep into the feelings of it because that's what she was all about. That's, that was her power. That was the power of her art. She could communicate that to people. And when she communicated that song, it turned the place into like a cathedral of mourning. You know, it, it just, it changed people. And, you know, the downside was that it really brought her to the attention of the authorities. I mean, she had been arrested as a girl when she first moved to New York, you know, rounded up for prostitution with her mother. But this brought her to the attention of the FBI and to Harry Anslinger and people of that, on that level. So from that time on, she was on their radar screen. And as she, you know, moved into, you know, the experience of heroin and addiction, she was on the radar screen of all of the not only the Federal Narcotics Bureau, but the local narcotics police. And it was a recipe for problems. So,
well, they harassed her mercilessly, and specifically over the singing of the song. Isn't that correct? I mean, they weren't they explicit in wanting this song stopped?
Yes, there were. You know, the song was recorded not on her main label. They refused to record it, but on another label. And when it was released, there were all kinds of problems. There were bookings that needed to be canceled. And yes, she would be harassed by the police, like literally to her deathbed.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And so I guess the reason I wanted this story, first, so happy that you told this story, and why I wanted to talk about it today is this, to me, this is one of the great acts of heroism from any person, and certainly a creative person, happens to be a jazz musician. But yeah, it has to have had a massive effect because there were no black singers singing with white orchestras before Billie Holiday. There were no black singers coming down and singing in you know, downtown in posh surroundings. She was a superstar. Any song she touched, and if you musicians know, if you look at a lot of the songs that Billie Holiday made famous, they're not great songs. She made them great.
Yeah,
And I can't even imagine what the social climate was like when she was active, because I wasn't there. But I mean, even now, nobody wants to look at the dark and dirty things that are being done to people. Can you imagine in that era, which was so regimented and so racist and so unyielding, for someone to step up like that and not just do it once? That's the thing I think that's so important. You know, it's not like she went up, sang the song, and it changed the world. She was up there every night singing this, you know, and taking very severe personal consequences for it. You give an account of her being actually physically attacked by an audience member who was so shaken.
A woman followed her into the ladies' room and, you know, like really went at her. She was hysterical. And it was because she had come to this club expecting, you know, a night of light entertainment and, you know, just kind of like chilling. And here she was hearing this song. And the fact of the matter was that as a girl, she had witnessed a lynching down south where a man had been, you know, dragged behind a car by his neck, strung up and burned. And, you know, it triggered that memory. And she went crazy, you know. And, you know, I mean, look, some of these characters are game changers, you know. I mean, not just in musical history, but in American history. Louis Armstrong is one example. I mean, you know, he was a game changer. you know, the first to go to Hollywood and do what he did, and, you know, to do it fearlessly in the face of, you know, death threats. Game changer. Billie Holiday, game changer. So it's kind of on one level, these entertainers are every bit as important as, you know, a Jackie Robinson or a Muhammad Ali. And, you know, you could really see that they were blessings for America in the long
run. Oh,
absolutely.
And the amazing thing is, in addition to that, they were incredible artists.
Oh, yes.
I mean, you just don't get better. You can't get better than them, you know, Billie Holiday, than Louis Armstrong. I mean, but and so in addition, I mean, because usually, you know, we have, and maybe this was true in Europe, I don't know, but, you know, Mendelssohn and Bach and all that, they were creating beautiful music, important music, world-changing music. But these artists not only did that, they also did, were involved in incredible social change at great personal risk to them. I heard a story, and this is maybe something that you didn't encounter because it's oral history, but it's straight from the guy that experienced it. I was down in New Orleans, and there was a conference on the Do Drop In, which is a famous part of the on the Chitlin circuit, where musicians, black musicians, could stay and eat and perform in safety, which was something that we haven't discussed. But it was physically unsafe for black people to travel from city to city in the South. But anyway, this young Louis Armstrong was a huge donor into the civil rights movement. A lot of people aren't aware of that, and he kept it quiet. The reason he kept it quiet, I heard directly from the man that was the guy that went to New York to get the checks from Louis Armstrong to bring back to the South for the purposes of the civil rights movement. He asked Louis, why don't you say more? And Armstrong said, look, I'm traveling in the South. I'm traveling in towns where I don't know if I might be killed, even just, or assaulted. I have to play it this way. So, yeah. And it's a shame that that there was a point when Louis Armstrong was considered by the younger generation to have been an Uncle Tom or you know, just a smiling Negro, you know, mm-hmm. when in fact that wasn't the case at all. He was doing what he had to do to survive. And
he was on the
so
front
many
lines.
Stories. So many stories. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's, to me, one of the great things about the story of jazz, and there are many, many great things, was how there were always people who were, like, deeply, deeply committed to the notion that music could be the thing that would bridge the racial divide in America. You know, John Hammond, for example, was one of those people. You know, he recorded Bessie Smith. He was, you know, there at the beginning of Billie Holiday when he, you know, first went to see her uptown. And, you know, there were others. I mean, Dizzy Gillespie was like that. He truly believed that, you know, and as such, he became an ambassador for that point of view. Now, Dizzy, if you look at Dizzy, he was like Pops, you know. He was a congenial smoker of marijuana. He was horrified by par drugs. You know, when he mm-hmm. saw what was happening to Charlie Parker, it was shattering to him. You know, Bird was like his brother, and there was nothing he could do to help him.
Yeah. I mean, you've either had that experience of having a loved one with this kind of problem, or you haven't. If you've had it, you know how horrible it is, and how traumatic it is, and how powerless you feel, because it's not something that's easily dealt with.
No. And in those days, there was nothing you could do. There was no place you could go except jail. I mean, there were the federal narcotics hospitals. But, you know, as you'd have to be arrested and sent there, or you could sign yourself in. The rate of relapse was astronomical. You know, mm-hmm. people would just go in and come out and get right back on dope, you know, for years and years and years. But there were no places that would treat an addict. You could not go into the hospitals of New York City, for example, if you were, you know, sick as an addict. until Billie Holiday's time. And this is one of the things I write about. I mean, Billie Holiday was, you know, a brilliant, important artist and, you know, game changer, as we've discussed. But she was also a very significant character in the history of addiction in America. I mean, when she was busted on her deathbed, really, and that became publicized, there was a program that had been submitted. For the first time, addicts were going to be allowed into the hospitals of New York City. And I don't think it would have been implemented without, you know, people seeing kind of what happened to her. You know, so she had an impact on recovery as well as an impact on, you know, just, you know, obviously musical culture and social issues. So, yeah.
These are people of great substance that you're writing about here on the jazz side. And I can't believe we've come to the end of our hour already, but I hope our listeners have learned a lot. I know I have. The book is Bop Apocalypse, which is a really well-chosen word for what happened. Bop Apocalypse, Jazz, Race, the Beats, and Drugs. We've been talking with the author, Martin Torgoff. It's published by the great publishing house of DeCapo Press. All praise to them for putting this excellent, important book in print. If you want to really get into the history of the music, this book is a gateway to that. It's very deep. And if you're also interested in the Beats, we didn't even talk about that aspect of the book, Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg.
The title comes from Allen Ginsberg's Howl. It was an image from Howl. And it was, like, to me, it just sums it all up. Yeah. Bop Apocalypse. Yeah. It's from the poem Howl, the breakthrough notorious poem. And it also happens to be one of the best tongue twisters ever invented. I dare anyone to try to say it 10 times fast.
I have to be honest. Every time I'm about to say it, I'm like, okay, brace yourself. This is going to make sure you get it out right.
Yeah.
Well, Martin, I
enjoyed talking to you, too, and I thank you for having me on, and I hope to talk to you again.
I hope so, too. And, well, again, I want to encourage everybody who's a serious student of jazz, this is an essential book. It will really fill out your multidimensional understanding of the great accomplishment that jazz music is. And, again, it's Bop Apocalypse, Jazz, Race, the Beats, and Drugs by Martin Torgoff, available from DeCapo Press.
Thank you.